This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Every year, thousands of infants die or are born with developmental disorders from a treatable pregnancy complication called fetal-maternal hemorrhage. Under the current standard of care, more than 80% of severe fetal-maternal hemorrhage cases are not identified because the existing technology is too expensive and time-consuming. I'm Alex Russell, CTO of Asta Fluidic Technologies. We have a solution that lowers the barriers to identifying this treatable condition. So, fetal-maternal hemorrhage, or FMH, is simply blood loss from the fetus to the mother. This is a condition that occurs in every pregnancy, and it's clinically significant to the point where it requires additional oversight in about 15% of pregnancies. It causes pregnancy complications like cerebral palsy, mental retardation, and death. But the great news is, all of these conditions can be prevented if this condition is identified. And that really leads us to the problem, the detection of fetal-maternal hemorrhage. Under the current standard of care in the United States, only 15% of pregnancies are screened for fetal-maternal hemorrhage. These are high-risk pregnancies, and they're the only ones that are screened because the existing technology is too time-consuming and expensive. And that would be fine if we were capturing all of those severe cases, but in reality, only 18% of severe hemorrhage cases are actually identified. And that's just accepted in the United States. So we've recognized that as a $450 million opportunity for ASTA to screen for severe fetal-maternal hemorrhage in the United States. So how did we come up with that number? Well, there's about 130 million pregnancies worldwide. The developed world accounts for a little less than 10% of those. And in the developed world, the United States is a little more than 50%. So looking at that market in the United States, we can break that up into two subsets. The first we call state-of-the-art. So under state-of-the-art, ASTA's technology is used to screen all of the high-risk pregnancies that are screened today. In the second segment we call becoming standard of care, ASTA's technology is used to screen even lower-risk pregnancies to capture those cases of severe fetal-maternal hemorrhage that wouldn't have otherwise been diagnosed. So these two segments combined constitute a $450 million market in the United States and approximately a $900 million market if you look at the entire developed world. And we're confident that we can capture this market primarily because of the way the test is performed today. The status quo is the Kleihauer-Betke test, or the KB test. This is a manual test that was developed in 1957. Now, when a doctor orders this test, he takes a blood sample, he sends it to a pathology lab, the technician gets that sample and he prepares a blood smear. That blood smear has a single layer of cells, he then goes through a series of staining and processing steps, puts the slide under a microscope, and has to manually count 10,000 cells and subjectively identify fetal cells and adult cells. Every step of this process is prone to human errors, and they occur. This is really how this condition is identified today. So ASTA's innovative solution uses microfluidic technologies to automate the sample handling and processing, as well as a handheld electronic reader to automate the analysis of this condition. So we're replacing a technology with that used to take 24 hours, during which the patient had to stay in the hospital, and that cost over $200, with a solution that costs $25 and can be performed in less than 10 minutes while the patient is still in the doctor's office. So you can see we're really changing the landscape here. And there's also some other methods of performing this test. I already talked about the Kleihauer-Betke test. But there's also the Rosette test. That's a qualitative test, also manual. subject to errors. And then there's flow cytometry, which although it's more sensitive, it's prohibitively expensive. So looking at this chart, it's easy to see that ASTIS technology is not only the cheapest and fastest method of diagnosing this condition, but it's also on par in terms of sensitivity with flow cytometry, the most advanced technology for identifying this condition. It's also important to note that ASTIS technology is the only one that is cheaper than the current reimbursement rate for identifying this condition. So ASTIS technology is 24 times faster, 8 times cheaper, and more reliable than the current state of the art. Everyone benefits from ASTIS technology, whether you're an insurer, a hospital, or a pathology department, you're saving money. Or if you're a patient or a clinician, you're receiving or giving better treatment. Now, ASTA is designing and developing this technology, but when we go to distribute, we are going to outsource the manufacturing of both the reader and the cartridge to experts in these manufacturing fields. When it comes to distribution, we will initially target high volume institutions such as trauma centers, and then we will seek group purchasing organizations to capture a larger market share. Although ultimately, we would like to partner with existing manufacturers and providers of maternal fetal care equipment. Our revenues will come from initial sales of the reader to hospitals, followed by recurring sales of the chips over time. And then there will be additional sales of the readers to larger hospitals that want to increase their volume as well as replacements, and then of course service contracts. So our team consists of strong engineering, medical, and management experience. Myself and John have several years' experience working in a biomicrofluidic research lab here at UCSB under the guidance of Professor Penether, who is a leader in micro and nanofluidic technologies, also a professor here at UCSB. On our team is also Dr. Alex Sofici, Director of Maternal Fetal Medicine at Cottage Hospital, and Mr. Anthony Schaubit, who has over 15 years of engineering project management experience. So we anticipate becoming cash flow positive in the second quarter of 2016. We anticipate making our first sale in the second quarter of 2016 and becoming cash flow positive in the third quarter of 2016. Initially, the majority of our revenue comes from the sale of the reader, and in the long run, our razor blade business model kicks in and the majority of our revenue comes from the sale of the chips. In terms of an exit strategy, we envision selling our company to an existing manufacturer and provider of point-of-care medical devices, especially one that has experience with microfluidics. There have been some exciting transactions in this space recently. Most notably was HemoQ, which was sold to Quest Diagnostics for $420 million in 2007. If you've ever donated blood, it's likely that you had your hemoglobin levels first checked with a HemoQ analyzer. Also was Verinata Health, was sold to Illumina earlier this year for $350 million. They're one of the four major players in non-invasive prenatal genetic screening, and we actually think our technology would be a good complement to their product line. So the founders have already contributed $55,000 to ASTA, but today we're seeking $350,000 to further secure our intellectual property, to increase the robustness of our prototype chip and reader, and to begin a series of alpha tests with doctors who we're already in touch with. We're also applying to government grants that we will use to supplement the $7.4 million we anticipate needing to get to market, and we anticipate the grants will account for about half of that. So as we go into the question and answer period, I'd like to leave these quotations from doctors and healthcare providers who are just as excited about our technology as we are. So with that, thank you for listening, and vote for ASTA.
Well, that was terrific, and actually finished a little bit. Please, have a seat. A little bit early, so we have plenty of time for our panel to get to work. So who wants to start?
Why not? What kind of technology validation have you already done that the technology works as you describe?
Yeah, so we've built an experimental proof of concept, and what this is a microfluidic chip where we've shown the ability to differentiate between fetal and adult red blood cells, which is really the indication that we're looking for.
You didn't say the word FDA at all, but I'd imagine sure. This is something that needs FDA approval. Is that what the $7.5 million is going to get you through, or tell me about that process here?
Yeah, so the $7.5 million will get us through FDA approval. Well, I should say FDA clearance. This will be regulated as a Class 2 in vitro diagnostic device. And we've actually spoke with some expert FDA consultants, and the anticipation is that our technology will be comparatively easy to get through the FDA. A couple of reasons. First is that flow cytometry has already gone through the FDA 510K approval process using the Kleihauer-Betke test as a predicate device. On top of that, there's commercially available control solutions that can be purchased to determine the sensitivity and specificity of our technology. And these are currently used to audit and train the technicians who perform the manual test today. So we estimate it will take roughly 18 months to go through the FDA approval process, but in reality, it'll probably be less than that.
So you show first revenue shipments out there at Q2 16, I think you said. So what are the barriers between now and then to get you there? Why so long, I guess, is the question.
Well, the majority is going to be building it and then going through the FDA approval process. So a big chunk of that time is going through the FDA, but we also have to make sure that our device is sensitive, is specific, and works every single time. And that's going to take some time. We're confident. We've convinced ourselves that we can build it, but that is an engineering challenge that we have to face.
Is this a finger stick? Is that what you do?
Yeah, so it depends on where the test is being performed. The test is currently performed in a pathology lab, and the mother's blood samples, which is what's used for this test, is already sent to the pathology lab.
Right.
So initially, it's not required to be a finger prick, but in the long run, that could be done.
But your product is a finger stick?
It could be. It doesn't require a finger stick or a blood draw. It could be either one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the microfluidic chip that you've built, that's what you really have. That's what this is here.
Right.
And it's the evaluation tool instead of this.
Right.
Repeating your pitch back to you, but I just want to make sure I get it.
Yeah.
And where else is this microfluidic technology already used? Is it mostly in medical stuff, or is it in, other technologies? I mean, where did you kind of come up with this concept that, hey, we can use this technology for, mothers?
Yeah, well, certainly it's being used for a lot of applications, really sensitive detection mechanisms, either for any sort of infectious disease diagnostic or for, any sort of like toxic chemicals, like airborne chemicals. But the idea for our technology and our company really came from a discussion between Professor Penether and Dr. Alex Safici during Professor Penether's second pregnancy. She was visiting Dr. Safici, and they got to talking about the needs of high-risk obstetric care and the capabilities of her research, and that's when they realized there was an unmet need and an opportunity to make a solution.
Can you talk a little bit about getting your process standardized within all screening that takes place in every pregnancy versus it being an elective choice that a mother would make?
Right. So there are certain conditions where the test is ran today, and that's our initial market is to target those high-risk pregnancies. And those are ones where there's been some sort of a trauma, pregnancy trauma, like a car accident or the mother's fallen down the stairs, or a blood type incompatibility between the fetus and the mother, where the mother's at risk of having an immune response. So really, the cases of the blood type incompatibility it's known when they occur. The traumas, it's a little bit iffy. I mean, the majority of those severe bleeds occur in non-trauma incidents. So that's really the portion of the market that we're going for there. And in terms of getting that approved, that is going to require a longer-term clinical study to show that screening in all pregnancies is actually capturing these missed cases. So it's not something we can go out on day one and say, okay, well, before we were screening high-risk pregnancies, now we're going to screen every pregnancy. We're going to go out and screen the high-risk pregnancies, but also start screening low-risk pregnancies and start identifying those cases and say, hey, look, we're preventing these cases of cerebral palsy, mental retardation, and death that are not only huge economic burdens on the state, but they're also huge social burdens.
So in the U.S., the addressable market is, as you indicated, the 15% of 6 million? And that's what you're
right. So that's the yeah. 40 million. Well, the United States as well as Europe and the rest of the developed
okay.
world.
Yeah.
I'm going to follow up on it if I can.
Yeah, please.
Because I'm not satisfied. So who is it that's going to demand the changeover of the test? There's these vested interests out there that are just perfectly happy doing the test as it is for the amount of money it costs. Is it the insurance company? Is it the doctor? And how are you going to get them to demand the change?
Yeah, so we've spoke to pathologists who run this test, and the current Kleihauer-Becky, and you know, when one of those tests gets ordered, they run for the hills. They can't stand running one of those. So they're excited about it, but then it becomes whether it's financially beneficial for the hospital. And I think there we're really going to have to go after a lot of the hospital administrators who see those hidden costs in having to keep the patient while the current test is being performed. So at best, the KB test can be returned in 4 to 6 hours, but more standardly, it's about 24 hours, and the patient has to stay in the hospital during that time. So I think it's really going to be a collaborative effort of getting the pathologist to say, yeah, we want this, as well as the clinician who says, yeah, the faster result is beneficial, I can give care sooner, and then the hospital administrator saying, okay, yeah, we're saving money here.
And your business model calls for direct salespeople to go and do that?
So initially, we're looking to do the direct sales to large volume hospitals where the return on investment is clear. But ultimately, I think it'll make sense to partner with existing manufacturers of maternal fetal care equipment or go into some sort of licensing agreement before we actually make a direct sale.
Thank you. Imagine you have the week off from work. You fly to Santa Barbara, you arrive at your high-end luxury hotel, you check in at the front desk, they give you your room key, you get to your room, put your bags down, and you're about to go hang out by the pool all day. Only first, you have a few things to take care of. First of all, you need to book dinner reservations for you and your spouse. You also want to do the Santa Barbara thing while you're in town, so you want to get guided hiking tours and surfing lessons. And lastly, while on the plane, the flight attendant hit your right arm and you bumped and spilled wine all over the only nice shirt that you have. So now you need laundry service. So what do? Well, you go to Google, of course, because they have all your answers, and you walk out and you purchase the services that you need within the community. Now, the reality is that all the services that I mentioned and that you needed were offered by the hotel all along. So instead of spending that relaxing, enjoyable day by the pool, you wasted an entire day of your vacation when the hotel could have been serving these needs for you. This lack of communication and awareness is also a huge issue for marketing directors because they stand there and watch as revenue walks right out the door. My concierge puts the front desk of a hotel and its internal and information on its internal services in the pocket of every guest, ready to answer their wants and needs as they arise. So now, as a guest needs laundry service or wants to book a hiking tour, they know exactly who to call on. This increased engagement is expected to drive internal service revenue by $400,000 annually. Here's an example of how it'll work. So let's say I'm a film director from LA. Kind of like that title. And I'm in town for the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And I'm naturally going to have a few questions. I'm going to want to know maybe when it starts and where it's located. So as the front desk had prompted me, I downloaded this app. And I got the hotel in my pocket and apparently my name tag as well. And so I text them because I want to know where it starts and where the location is. And I'm happy because shortly after, they're able to respond. But that's not all. We have a software that collects and keeps all the communication between hotels and its guests. It sorts, tags, and aggregates them for hotel managers so they can see how the wants and needs of their guests are evolving in real time. So as you can see here, I'm one of just 70, which will soon be 100 guests who are interested in information on the Santa Barbara Film Festival. Managers can then scale the environment slightly to fit the wants and needs of their guests and drive internal service revenue. So they know that I'm going to want that from these 100 guests, there's going to be a need for taxis or that a lot of them might drive themselves. But if they're able to line up shuttles, then that's lowering the convenience for me to simply walk into the services and give them revenue from my pocket. So how do we know that hotels want this? Well, we went out and performed 120 market validation interviews, talked to a lot of hotel managers and bothered a lot of hotel guests. And the two main issues was that, one, this huge lack of communication. Guests sleep in the beds of hotels, yet the only time they communicate is when they check in. And the second is that the job of a marketer is to be able to quantify and evolve your business to fit the wants and needs of your customer base, yet hotels have no way of doing this. They know generally who their customers are, but they don't have the quantitative data that shows them how to scale their communication and the services they offer. So where are we at right now? The beauty of, at least for me, is that this idea is no longer theoretical. We have a customer, the Bacar Resort and Spa, that we'll be rolling our product out to at the beginning of the summer. We also have been in constant talks with the Spanish Garden Inn, the Four Seasons, and Hotel Vital in San Francisco. And we have the third face-to-face meeting with the Biltmore next Friday. This time it's with the marketing director and the GM. So we expect to seal them as our second customer. Market size, we have 1.5 million home away from home, so hotels, motels, timeshares, property managers who own multiple properties. The sub-aggregate from that is the hotel industry worldwide, which is 202,000 and growing. And we're targeting the top 5% high-end luxury because they have the most to gain from our services, simply because they offer the most services. Our brief business model, we charge a subscription fee of 1.8 times the average price of the room. This comes out to about $12,000 annually. In exchange, we provide the guests with an increase in customer service, and the guests drive revenue for the hotel. That arrow is 100% upside down. The hotel does not pay the guests money. If they did, I would be staying at that hotel right now. We also provide the hotel analytics. With this process, we're going to be building a large database of customer information. So although it's on a periphery right now, down the line, we want to be able to sell hotels a pick and a cart so they can mine some of that guest data. Financials, we plan to be profitable halfway through year two. Our expenses revolve mainly around human resource. We needed a killer sales team. Not much more, a couple developers, a marketing team that knows how to generate leads, maybe just one or two. It only took us $50 to build the app. So it's really the human resource that we need. Competition, there's a company called Intellity. They're based in Orlando, Florida, and another company called Run Trends here in LA. Intellity, I've been studying them for a long time. I'm not 100% sure what their minimum viable competitive advantage is. They kind of just offer hotels a complete total upgrade the iPad in the room, they have a channel on the TV, and they offer a mobile app. And RunTriz has competitive advantage is the ability to upsell goods and services to their highest clientele through push deals and notifications. Again, no one solves the fundamental issue that we do of simply letting hotels understand who they're serving a little bit better. We're asking for $1 million in funding. Again, human resource costs money, and we need a sales team, a marketer, a designer, a few things for the office, just tidy things up, and general supplies. And again, it'll get us to that break-even point. Our team, my name's Nick Rosen, I'm our CEO. I study mindfulness psychology. We also have David Reed here. He's our CMO, Chief Marketing Officer. He's worked for startups in the marketing department. Thomas Carley is our CTO. This guy's such a great entrepreneur that this last weekend at the Stravaganza Music Festival, he made a substantial profit selling handfuls of ice, which is pretty genius. Austin Ramazami Dulabi is in the crowd. He's our iOS developer, and Tali Tadesh, who's programmed apps before, is our Android guy. Seth Epstein has been a great advisor to have. He started a company called Social Stay in 2006, also built mobile applications for hotels. He's a visionary. In fact, if you go to his LinkedIn profile, his picture stares right through you. Jim Terrazin's helping us along with business development. Top five most enthusiastic guy I know. And David Thielen Lawden, who was a Steve Blank before Steve Blank existed. He started Market Validation in 1983, has pushed us along in that process, and we've been really appreciated, you know, having that advising team. At this point, all I can really say is let the games begin. It's been a great process, and we can't wait to push it further. Thank you very much.
Hold on. Thank you. Do you want to take... Good. We're going to let you sit down. Okay, panel. Have Adam.
Right.
Colleen.
I definitely have questions. First of all, great pitch. And congratulations on getting the testing demo situation with the Bacara. That sounds huge, so that's great. And it sounds like you're talking a lot to hotels. You've got the Four Seasons. You've got Hotel Vital, all this great stuff. But from the customer perspective, I just need to hear a little bit more about, you know, if I check into the Bacara this fall, what do they say to me? They say, you need to download this app, either the iPhone or the Android app. Tell me, you know, through that process on the customer side.
Sure. So that is a barrier that we've been out trying to solve, and one of the ways that we're solving it is by when you book your reservation online, a QR code will pop up and tell you the benefits of downloading the app. There'll also be one at the front desk. Now, the front desk has an incentive to sell this because what it does is it gets them mobile. By increasing the amount of communication, it also increases the amount of service that they provided the guests.
No, I totally understand why the hotel would want me to have this, but why do I want to have this? Because I love being at the hotel and not having to talk to the concierge at all and
sure.
Have him refer me to a brother-in-law's restaurant and have, you know, his friend who's a cab driver pick me up and get a kickback from that. I love using my Uber, using my Yelp, you know, for me as a customer, what's my motivation?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is the opportunity to have a mobile butler, in a sense. We all want the ability to have our wants and needs served as they arise. And if you're at the pool and you don't have access to your computer, or you're with your spouse and you want chocolate and flowers delivered to your room upon arrival, these specific type of requests that a hotel can offer that really isn't being taken advantage of right now for guests, and that the hotels are willing to offer, but there's just a very low or very high barrier for guests to be able to fulfill their needs kind of as they arise.
So I get the customer interface. What's the hotel interface? What does that show up on their computer screen, or is everybody running around looking at their phone every 2 minutes?
Yeah. So Instant Messenger is probably the best
the best word I could use for that. They have all the numbers of the text that they receive. It's simply lined up, basically a mere reflection of Instant Messenger. So they type in the answers as they come in.
But how do they discriminate where it's coming from?
Well, down the line, we want to be able to put a GPS in. Right now, they simply have to ask. Are you at the pool?
Room are you in?
Sure, what room are you in? Or if someone texts them from the pool, where can we find you?
So the customer has to identify themselves when they send the text, right?
Yeah, which can be a good thing because a lot of customers don't want the hotel to know exactly who they are every time they text.
Okay.
Can you walk me through your revenue model again, 1.8 times the room cost?
Sure.
100 hotel rooms, $400 a night at the Barcara, 250, 1.8 times that, the annual fee. It seems pretty expensive for the service you're offering.
Yeah. Our pricing's based on competitor-based pricing and also simply our market validation process of asking hotels what they'd pay for it. Mm-hmm. And we got between $500 and $2,000 a month is what they said. Intellity charges $1,000 a month, locked-in fee for 3 years. So you have to sign a 3-year contract right out of the gate. Based on their model and, again, our validation, we found that 1.8 times the price of the room was reasonable, and we could still sell it to 2- and 3-star hotels at a price that they could afford.
And that's 1.8 times the average room price monthly. So that's about $1,000 a month, and so annually that's $12,000.
What differentiates you from Intelli?
Again, Intelli provides a total upgrade, but we solve this fundamental issue of the fact that there could be a world of commerce going on in a hotel, but there's simply no interaction. And one of the reasons for that is because the guest behavior can't be quantified. Hotels don't really know how their guests are interacting with their services. In other words, they're frustrated that people are always changing, but hotels always stay the same. And they get pinned the blame for that because it's on them to be able to upsell their goods and services, and they simply don't know how because they don't know how their customers are changing.
Do you see any barriers to the next set of college kids doing the same thing once you have just a little teeny bit of success?
You know, I'm not a huge IP guy. I think that we have a great team, and I have full confidence in these guys and the future guys to be able to execute in a manner that's better than any competitor that comes aboard. I think IP is playing not to lose a little bit, but I'm really going out and executing is playing to win, and that's our strategy. So I'm not real concerned. I think we'll make the adjustments as they come.
And also to add on to that, the $1 million that we're asking for is going to pay for a really kick-butt marketing team. And what we want to do is scale as absolutely quick as we can. And after we start gathering this huge database of just data, that'll be a big advantage. So even if somebody comes along and they have exactly the same application, they won't have all the data that we do.
So, and just to follow up on Colleen's question, in terms of incentive for me, the customer, to want to use the app or text a message to the concierge, if you can make dry cleaning my shirt cost less than $20, that would really be good.
I'm still struggling a little bit with the revenue model. You said it's 1.8 times the nightly rate per month per room for this?
Not per room. So say like the average room cost in the Bacara is like, I'm making these numbers, $400. The monthly fee we would charge them, hotel a monthly fee. And so that'd be about $1,000 for the Bacara. And so that's $12,000 annually. And we'd scale that based on the hotel.
Okay, so the Bacara would pay you $12,000 for all of the, to use it throughout the whole hotel.
Correct.
Have you looked at alternative revenue models like downloads or something like that? I mean, charging
the hotel
for that?
We don't want to provide a disincentive to use the application. If we do something like based on the number of like messages that the hotel receives, then that gives them like a reason to try to like use other means of communication aside from our application. Just having a really easy to understand fee is that's what they want.
But how about downloads? You're going to control the downloads. Could you charge the hotel for downloads?
I mean, you could, but that's the same thing about providing them a disincentive of trying to find a different means of doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Makes sense.
On the discussion of brand integrity, when you're talking to folks like the Bacara and Biltmore and folks that really are trying to project an image of a great brand, have they tried to get you to kind of white label your service for them specifically, or are you, really trying to push your myconciergemobile.com name into the ecosystem of hotels?
Take it.
We build like personalized applications for them, but we do own everything about it, if that answers your question.
Kind of. So if I'm the Bacara, I'm going to tell you, great, I like it, but it's going to be me, not you, that the customer sees. And I'm just curious how you would address that, and if you are trying to push your name in the forefront from the download, the app itself, or if you're looking to be a service for the hotel and keep your name in the background.
That's a good question. The Bacara might be kind of a one-off because they're actually allowing us to advertise on the app itself. There's an information page that's just about us. I don't know if all the hotels are going to be as generous. That's something that's going to need to be addressed, and I haven't given a lot of thought of it as far as branding. Got to kind of be honest there. I think hotels do want to kind of overlay their app as their own. So there'll be a little negotiating there, but I think we'll be able to finagle something in there to get our name on the app always.
Hello, everyone. We are Komodo Interactive. In every industry, there exist elements which have been proven to give products lasting appeal. In the toy industry specifically, let's look at what attributes have made the biggest recent franchises so successful. Pokemon's emphasis on strategic battles and collecting them all has made it a worldly renowned sensation. While LEGO Mindstorms is loved by both parents and children alike for being a development kit for kids to build their own autonomous robots. Most recently, however, Skylanders has revolutionized the toy industry with its new toy and video game hybrids. In the last year and a half, Skylanders has sold more than $1 billion in unit sales. By incorporating the most attractive elements of these products, Komodo Interactive has created a customizable, remote-controlled fighting robot toy. Each part of this robot is completely interchangeable. Children will be able to choose from new arms, chest pieces, heads, and other accessories with which to customize their own personalized toy. Because of the vast number of permutations possible, no two robots will be alike. Children will control these robots wirelessly in dynamic and strategic battles. Through the common drive for competition, children can then purchase new accessories with which to upgrade and enhance the robotic champions. This product incorporates video game elements like automated scoring and health system. And as you can see right now, here's our very first prototype of this product. No toy like this exists in the market because of the complexity of manufacturing each unit. However, the central part of our toy contains all of the most expensive components, such as the circuitry, the sensors, the motors, and the power supply. This means that all other accessories will be made out of just plastic injection molding. Therefore, all other accessories will have very high profit margins, and children will be driven to purchase many accessories with which to upgrade their robot. The children's toy market is one of the most stable in the world. It is able to weather economic downturns, for parents will always want to purchase something nice for their children. Furthermore, the kids in the age group between 7 and 12 constantly repopulates itself every couple of years. meaning that children will be able to pass down our robot from generation to generation. How are we sure that a market for fighting robots exists? In 2001, Rumble Robots was released. Rumble Robots is a far inferior version of our product. It does not have customizability. It does not have video game elements. It does not have, and it's very clunky and actually quite unfun. This vastly inferior version of our product sold over 2 million units, making $100 million in revenue. Our breaking point for profitability is at 30,000 units sold. Comparing this to our estimated minimum growth, which is 2 million units based off of the sales of Rumble robots in 2001, you can see that there's a large amount of room for profitability. If we compare these numbers, which are from 2001, to the current state of affairs in the toy industry today, you can see that there's a large amount of growth possible in the toy industry, with Skylander selling 100 million units in the past year and a half. Our current price point sits at $50 for each starter pack, meaning that a kid can take the starter pack, unbox it, and start playing with the robot straight out of the box. Our real profit, however, lies in the accessory packs, which are sold for $11 per unit. We are estimating a profit of $4 million in 2 years, which would then grow to $68 million in 5 years, with a very conservative estimate of 2 million units sold in 5 years. Our product will be manufactured in Southeast Asia and then stored and fulfilled entirely through Amazon online services. As our product begins selling through online channels, retailers will become interested in acquiring and selling our product. Our justification for using Amazon fulfillment services is that Skylanders, which I have mentioned earlier for selling 100 million units in 1.5 years, has made all of their online sales entirely through Amazon. This is a tried and true method used by leading players in the toy industry. In the next couple of months, we plan to continue product development with one of our mentors, John Stump. We will be developing our product into a marketable stage for a Kickstarter campaign, for our product has every element of a successful Kickstarter campaign. We hope that through crowdfunding, through these means, we will be able to continue developing in preparation for stage two investment. And in order to solidify our appeal to the public, we hope to make strategic licensing agreements with products that kids are really into, such as Star Wars, like a Star Wars Komodo hybrid toy. Our exit strategy relies primarily on acquisition by a larger corporation. No competitor currently exists for fighting robot toys. The closest thing is a Hexbug Warrior, which kids cannot control themselves, for they run around on a little track. Furthermore, when kids upgrade their Hexbug Warriors, it does not impact the ability of the robot in any way. I've also included Rumble Robots, although they were back from 2001, for Jack Specific has acquired that intellectual property, and they can reintroduce the product line into market if they see that Komodo Toys is making a profit. This is our team. I am Ben Shookman. I am a physics and art history double major. I have worked on over 5 business ideas in the last year, including several iPhone applications, a legal case management software, a food truck, and a film festival. My partner, Patrick Clary, is a UCSB mechanical engineer, and he is one of the lead developers at the robotics club here at our school. Marketing is going to be the key deciding factor with our product. And because of this, we are searching for an experienced marketing professional to join our team. We also have 2 advisors, David Dexter, who is extremely experienced in Southeast Asian manufacturing. We rarely get to see him because he's out of town every other week. And John Stump, who has had 15 years experience in plastics product development and manufacture. John Stump will be helping us solidify our product into a marketable level for our Kickstarter campaign. And with that, we are asking for $800,000 of startup capital to get us to launch. We have a very slim window of opportunity with which we can aggressively expand into the toy market, and we have the idea and the determination to get us there. Thank you for your consideration.
Well done.
Go ahead and sit down.
So I can see our panel is just waiting to pounce. So have at it.
Go ahead.
Can you make a move again?
I see a fight.
Okay, so the arms. Wow. Great work, guys. Really nice presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to hear a little bit more about, you know, the two of you and, you know, why you're the ones to do this, because I've talked to a couple toy startups that Kickstarter model, and you're right, Kickstarter loves this shit. But, you know, the giant players in this market are ruthless, and they will copy your idea tomorrow. And why can your little team, you know, what is the spark of idea here?
Through this competition and independently from our work in the past two quarters, we have been working very aggressively in finding mentors, finding people that can help us, and the underlying success behind our product will be how quickly we can move into this market once we actually release it to the public eye. Once it's in the public eye, it can be picked up immediately. And because of that, we need to set everything up as soon as possible such that once we do our Kickstarter campaign, we can follow up with whatever success we may have as quickly as possible. And because of that, I think we are very I think the two of us will be able to do it because we have met we have met amazing people through this competition, and we have also had several people come up to us with connections to leading toy companies in Canada and in America, and we hope that we'll be able to follow up with a Kickstarter campaign by contacting these toy companies first. And yeah, I hope that answers the question.
And is there any way that the movement itself can be customizable as well? I'd love to see something with an open API that kids mm-hmm. can then program mm-hmm. to. Is that anything that could happen here?
Oh,
yeah, that's definitely something that we're considering. At the moment, the movement is based on a very simple model of there's a little thing that turns, and how that actually gets translated into movement all depends just on the mechanics of the arm. And so we're planning on having many different arms that you can potentially attach to the same thing. Some of them might be different kinds of punches. Some of them might be like a drill or anything else.
I would also really quickly like to follow up that it does not have to be limited to just punching. For example, we can have laser guns that just go on, and you can have a laser gun robot, for example, or any limitless combination. The more permutations we can have in our robot, the more profitability we can have with the amount of accessories we can sell. And also, hacking is a very, very big part of most toys, actually. And so if we can appeal to toy hackers in any way by allowing them to customize and design their own arms, that can even be part of our profit model, where we have weekly competitions for new arms or new designs. And then kids can vote for their favorite designs, and then we can go and market those.
What's a controller look like? Is it an iPhone or?
Oh.
At the moment, our controller is a hacked-up GameCube controller. we've also had it running through a computer. It's all running using a fairly simple wireless radio signal.
So, what would you go to market with?
We will go to market with our own personal remote controller. We can also sell different kinds of remote controls at launch. It can also be controlled through an iPhone. So we hope to have an iPhone application, and this iPhone app can have stats on your wins and losses. They can control your robot, and we really hope that you can have like a little, almost like a closet, where you can design the robot of your dreams, and then go bug your mommy until she like gets the oldest parts, right?
Just to change subjects for a second. So the money you need to get this thing going, you're asking for $800,000 here, and then you said the next thing is a Kickstarter campaign and then stage two. Can you talk about what those numbers might
yes,
be?
Yes, of course. The $800,000 is actually independent of our Kickstarter campaign. Regardless of what kind of capital seeding we may find right now, we hope to continue with product development, get to that Kickstarter campaign, and we hope to actually look much more aggressively for investment once we have our product at a very marketable level. And that will be funds that we will be able to put into the product ourselves to get to that level. The $800,000 would be from taking that Kickstarter campaign marketable level into launch. That's what we need for launch, such as getting all the molds made and working with Amazon and payroll for mechanical engineers and designers, online website, there's a ton. CPSC testing for toys is very restrictive and all that.
So the $800,000 would be the stage two funding?
Yes.
And what are you looking for from a Kickstarter campaign?
From a Kickstarter campaign, we'll be searching for around 25,000.
Okay.
You can probably add a few zeros to the Kickstarter campaign. I think it's going to take off. You mentioned CPSC certification for toys. Can you kind of walk me through that process? And then a second question after that would be intellectual property. If there is anything patentable in your main unit or the device itself, and if there's any infringement with the predecessor from 2001.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As far as CPSC, we've been speaking to government agencies regarding toy safety and consumer product safety. And the way it works is that there's independent contractors for consumer product safety testing throughout the United States, and you contact these independent contractors individually, speak to them about what your toy is and what you need tested, and they will tell you all the different kinds of tests that need to be done to make the toy good for launch. There's an enormous amount. Some of them require, like, say if we have tracks, for example, that's another test. There's electronic tests, there's different kinds of plastics, lead tests, and so we'll have to go through all of those different tests before we can even manufacture our robot. As far as your second question for IP, most of our robot is not patentable. However, the big patentable part of our robot is the connection between the joints. From the chest piece to the arms, we can patent that coupling such that no third-party developer can make arms and accessories compatible with our core components. Okay. So, however, the electronics we're using and the mechanics we're using has all been done maybe 20 years ago. We're not using any new technology, and for that, it's not a very patentable technology.
I actually think there could be some interesting patent technologies that you could work with. So I challenge you to do a little more research on what you can actually patent with that process there.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
I'll take the moderator's prerogative and ask the last question. Maybe we have another question from the panel. I started out my career in journalism in Springfield, Massachusetts, where there was a company called Milton Bradley. Down the road was Coleco. They would never show up with a prototype like that and TV cameras and all kinds of stuff in the room. And I think if you have any success at all, you're going to have copycats like that. That's not my question. My question is, what if Costco or Walmart or somebody comes to you and says, we love it, kids, we'll cut you a break, we won't cut your legs off, or take it to Mattel, but you got to give it to us for under $30. Mm-hmm. Can you do it? Because as a one-off product, they're just going to grind your butts down on cost.
Our current pricing model sits at $50 per starter unit sold. I have constantly argued that the lower we sell that starter kit for, down to $35 or maybe even $30, the more robots will be out there. And when kids see other robots, these franchises spread like wildfire in schools, through friends, and the more robots out there, the more kids will be purchasing accessories, which is where our primary profitability comes from. But it's all about the...
But how much can you afford to lose, or how low can you grind the cost of that down?
We believe we'll be able to manufacture each robot for approximately $15 to $20 for the starter kit. The accessories are very, very cheap, less than a couple of cents to manufacture for each arm, each new component, each chest piece, and for that we can lower the price point of that also.
Final question, panelists?
You said that your predecessor in 2001 was unfun. I love that, but what makes this more fun? What's so fun about it?
It's actually a lot more dynamic. Our predecessor, in order to win a game of Rumble Robots, he had two robots and he had two springs sticking out of the back. And you'd have to drive your robot around the other one. And also, they couldn't do this. Sorry. They couldn't do the waist rotation with us. It couldn't do this kind of waist rotation, so they also didn't have as dynamic controls. And our robots will have health bars. So it won't be like one punch to the spring, we'll just get it out. It'll have, you'll be able to purchase new weapons that do more damage to health bars or different kinds of damage. And it really introduces like strategic thinking with, okay, what do I want for this battle specifically against this kid specifically? I know about his robot, I heard it from the other kids. I'm worried, you know? So you can build up an arsenal of accessories and you can build up an arsenal of accessories, and it's really, really fun, actually.
I love this new generation. No guns in the house, but we all fight with robots. Thank you all. That's the end of our last. presentation.
Here we go, guys. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So what we liked about NAPSE was that they not only took care of digitizing the readers, but they also addressed something that nobody else has addressed, and that was addressing the copyright. And in that, they also recognize that there's some challenges in doing that. And it's right now going to be a back office function, but they recognize they need to go out and figure out how to do that. We like the team that they put together, and we like the fact that they've already have a rollout plan starting here at the UC and then rolling it out through California. So those were some of the things that we like. And although I'm no longer in school, if I was, I'd use their service. So congratulations.
Not only do you have a working prototype, you have a cool product, a very large addressable market, and we think the skill set for two people to really take a toy company to the next level. And it was because of that that we've chosen you as the second place winner for this competition. Congratulations.
So the first place winner, it wasn't totally simple to decide, but this team was just so mature and so far along for this type of a competition. Very, very impressive core technology, very well-identified market, put together a great team of advisors. Asta Fluidic Technologies wins first.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.